argument is Fisher v. Avanade. Ms. Kane.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Lisa Kane, and I am representing the appellant. The issues before this Court are whether the plaintiff produced sufficient evidence from which taken as true with all doubts resolved in her favor, with all evidence construed in the light most favorable to her, and all reasonable inferences drawn in her favor, a rational trier of fact could reasonably find the defendant discriminated against the plaintiff because of her sex, and whether a rational trier of fact could reasonably find that the defendant constructively discharged plaintiff in retaliation for her complaining of sex discrimination.
Ms. Kane?
Yes.
Was there evidence that the job requirement of a Microsoft certified professional certification had been strictly enforced in other instances by the company?
Actually, Your Honor, there was testimony that, and there was an email as well from Mr. Kilman stating that if in the event of a level 55 position, there should be certifications that are required for the applicant who would receive such a position. So there was indeed. And that testimony was laid out in our statement of facts.
What is this gentleman's club they refer to? What does that mean?
The gentleman's club? Well, there's two references with regard to that in this particular case. The first being that there was an incident in which several of the workers got together and they went to a gentleman's club.
What is a gentleman's club?
Oh.
A gentleman such as you is unaware of what a gentleman's club is?
Thank you, Judge Rothner. I really appreciate that.
Topless bar or something?
Yes. Yes, Judge Posner. I think that was exactly where they went, was to a topless bar. In this particular case, it was quite unique what the defendants chose to do on summary judgment. The plaintiff, we had taken approximately 18 depositions, overlapping with another case, Rafferty versus Avanade. And at summary judgment, the defendant chose to rely on 11 affidavits to support their Rule 56 statement. And in particular, two of the affidavits that the defendant relied on, they had not utilized the Rule 26A1 disclosure with regard to giving us proper information and knowledge as to those particular witnesses. Further, there were contradictions of the decision makers with regard to the positions that the plaintiff was applying for that came out as a result of further embellishments created at the time of the Rule 56 by the defendant, which caused contradictions between their earlier testimony and that which was incorporated in the affidavit. And with regard to the qualifications, as this court has acknowledged in Walker, specifically, obviously a company is free to make its exceptions to its rules when necessary. But in the two positions, and there's foundational information that was utilized by the plaintiff for earlier decisions that were also evidence of discrimination, for the October 2004 practice director position, of which Mr. Severdeen ultimately received, and of which the plaintiff in this particular case was completely unaware of. And most importantly, in the evidence that was elicited through discovery, there were very interesting emails, and especially in light of the fact that in the 2004 decision, which was another position which was created with regard to the strategic accounts regional director position, it was there was an email basically indicating by Mr. Mendel that the plaintiff wasn't even going to be considered to be a candidate. And nonetheless, the plaintiff interviewed for the position on May 5th. At the time of her interview, she was sharing the position with Mr. Severdeen, and she inquired of Mr. Mendel, well, what about Mr. Severdeen? I mean, is he going to be applying for this position? He specifically said he's not practice director material. The reason that this is highly relevant is because within 2 weeks of making the decision to move Lewis into the position, of which, of course, plaintiff ultimately did not receive it, Mr. Silverdane was then promoted into the central region to another acting director position, which he ultimately received in October of 2004. The further interesting notes with regard to the evidence in this case is, initially for the strategic accounts region position, there was a specific criteria that had been outlined in a posting. At the time of the final decision, which took place in May of 2004, the criteria was no longer going to be utilized. And there was a mosaic of circumstantial evidence supporting discriminatory conduct, not the least of which was the fact that there was a dispute of fact as to whether or not there was a posting policy that was being utilized by the defendant, and of which the defendant argues that does not create a material issue of fact. But I think what the defendant lost sight of in their brief to this court is it is the moving party's burden to show that the undisputed facts, of which there is no material fact, for a trier of fact to decide. And I respectfully submit that given all of the evidence that was extrinsicated in discovery in this matter, plaintiff clearly pointed out there were some large discrepancies with regard to the decision-making process of the defendant. And more importantly, as a result, and learning of various things that were going on that seemed to be somewhat clandestine in nature, the plaintiff brought this with another woman to the attention of the CEO in April of 2005. During that phone call, which took place between several women, including both Fisher and Rafferty, Mr. Hill, who was the CEO, who was also on the phone with Mr. Friedman, who was of HR, demanded that they identify themselves as to who they are, what their complaints are. Only Fisher and Rafferty identified themselves. And no action was ever taken by the defendant to address any type of sex discrimination complaint. No investigation took place. No questions were ever asked. They suggested that come forth with your information. But the women were very specific. How do we move up? How do we get promoted? There was only one woman who was in the executive committee worldwide. In order to progress into an executive level position, these women needed to attain the positions of managers and directors in order to basically see their goals come to fruition. It just wasn't happening. No matter what they did, the criteria was changing. And that is truly the evidence that we brought forth in our response to the defendant's summary judgment. At this time, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for my rebuttal.
Okay, that's
Thank
fine.
You.
Thank you, Ms. Kidd.
Thank you.
Mr. Boggs?
May it please the court. Your Honor, there are no sort of novel legal issues, and I will talk about some of the procedural allegations that were made. But really, this case is about whether there has been any material issue of fact raised about any claim that the plaintiff has brought that postdates September 24, 2004. Many of the claims...
Well, taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, doesn't the evidence show that Mr. Silverdane cost Avenue $600,000 with undocumented change
orders.
Change requests on a project as acting director, and also wouldn't the evidence show that he failed to provide great relationships with the bank, whereas Ms. Fisher was recommended for the position by both the bank's vice president and the bank's assistant vice president. And just that alone, isn't that enough to make this a jury issue?
No, it's not, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. First of all, you have to understand the position that was issued, and it's a little complicated because this is a technical company, but the name of the position was the Delivery Management Practice Director. And what they do is they deliver projects of technology to companies, and they wanted someone within the region to be the leader of all the people that were managing the project. And the criteria that were important, that were laid out in the document and that were identified, was have you ever led a major project? is one. And the second is...
Even if you've led a major project into a $600,000 deficit?
Your Honor, if you look at the facts of that project, it was a $600,000 deficit. The project was in the gutter. They had gone through three different people. And I may be overstating it, but Mr. Sieverding took that project and moved it from point A to point Z, cost him some money along the way, but overall in the organization, he got an exceeds expectations because it was in such bad...
Meets expectations.
Exceeds expectations.
I thought it was meets expectations.
Maybe I'm wrong here. I thought it was exceeds...
Yeah.
In any
he was
event.
Rated as meets expectations.
In any event, Your Honor, overall there were problems. I'm not saying that there weren't problems, but overall he got the project to the point where the customer was happy. And the other important part about the delivery management practice director position is that you have to be able to communicate and interact well with your coworkers. Mr. Sieverding did. There were complaints by Ms. Fisher's coworkers, both men and women, to Mr. Mendel, complaining about her demeaning and abrasive behavior. This is a leadership position. And it sort of goes to the other point you raised, Judge, about the whether or not Mr. Sieverding was certified with Microsoft. It wasn't a requirement for the delivery management practice director position. It was a requirement for the level 55, but what we're talking about here is the delivery management practice director position. And there's a lot of evidence of other people that didn't have certification. Frankly, Your Honor, the certification is more important for the low-level employees, that they know what they're doing.
Yeah,
for this position, you have to be a leader.
See, you argue, you know, throughout the brief that the mere deviation from policy doesn't establish pretext. But isn't it at least evidence of pretext and quite possibly strong evidence of pretext?
If it was on a major issue, it might be. The certification issue, Your Honor, in the scheme of what this position was, wasn't big. And again, this is a comparative qualifications issue. The issue for the jury isn't to decide whether Mr. Mendel got it wrong on the untimely claims when he gave it to Mr. Lewis, or whether Mr. Evans got it wrong when he decided to give the position to Mr. Sieverding over Ms. Fisher. The standard is whether their qualifications were so clearly different that no reasonable person could have given the job to Mr. Sieverding. And the two points that we have here is Mr. Evans, if we're looking at the central region position, which is the only timely position, looked at the situation. And you have to sort of understand the circumstance. Mr. Gamzo had to leave on very short notice from the delivery management practice director position because there was this opportunity with Best Buy, and he sort of went to sort of pursue that new opportunity. They needed a stopgap fill. It could have been a week. It could have been 2 weeks. They didn't know how long it was going to be. They weren't going to post for the position when it could be temporary. Mr. Sieverding had told Mr. Gamzo, hey, I'm interested in looking into the central region. They had a favorable impression upon him. They said, okay, you know, you get in that position. It isn't, though, they sort of vetted this out and sort of did a massive search through the organization. They didn't really, it wasn't that sort of a position. It could have been temporary. So they sort of had a person who was available, who was competent, and he got the position. It's not for us to sit here and second guess whether they should have, you know, went through the whole system and looked for the possible best candidate. They needed an immediate person. They knew Mr. Sieverding was available. Ms. Fisher was in a completely different region. She was in the strategic accounts region.
Right.
She wasn't
okay.
Even...
That brings up another question that I had. Thank you. When the strategic account region was restructured and the employees had to choose whether to transfer or, you know, move to Chicago, how many employees were affected by that? And is there any indication that the restructuring was meant to force Ms. Fisher out?
And there's a couple points there, Your Honor. First, the answer is no. What they wanted to do with this new region is have everybody close. It was sort of going to be sort of like a think tank where everybody should be in the same area as opposed to people working remotely.
So all employees were affected by that?
Only people that lived away from Chicago. Ms. Fisher lived in Iowa. There's a Mr. Eggleston who lived in Cleveland who worked remotely as well. He was in strategic accounts, and he had to make that same decision, and he chose the same thing Ms. Fisher did. But more importantly is that decision about restructuring strategic accounts not only was made before Ms. Fisher filed her charge, It was actually communicated to her before she filed her charge. It was Mr. Slattery's decision. Mr. Slattery wasn't even aware that there had been a charge filed, so there wasn't even any protected activity prior to the time that he made that charge, or at least no evidence that Mr. Slattery was aware of any protected activity. And that's undisputed evidence, Your Honor. In fact, all of the retaliation claims relate to 2005, when she was under the management of Mr. Slattery, and all of the issues, including the audit of expenses and the the poor performance review, all of that was communicated and decided before Ms. Fisher filed her charge. So it couldn't have been retaliation because there hadn't even been any protected activity that had been engaged in. And, Your Honor, in addition, with regard to the inconsistencies, and I don't know how important this is to Your Honors, but it was troubling to me, the two deponents or the two declarants that weren't used, they were to authenticate documents. It was an issue. The documents that were authenticated aren't particularly relevant to the issues on summary judgment now and certainly not relevant to the issues on appeal involving some unequal compensation claims. This issue was raised before Judge Hibbler. Judge Hibbler said, okay, Ms. Fisher, if you have an issue, go ahead and take their depositions before the summary judgment's decided. She didn't take their depositions because these issues were unimportant. So the fact that there was two declarants used to authenticate documents that were presented to the court, I think, is a non-issue. As far as the inconsistencies with the deposition transcripts, again, there are no inconsistencies, and I can go into those, but and I would point to a couple. The one is that she claims about, or complained about, is that when asked the question, why didn't Ms. Fisher get the position, she says the answer was Joe Sieverding got it. And then in his declaration, he goes into more detail. But what Ms. Cain and Ms. Fisher ignore was that earlier in the deposition, the witness had spent a long time explaining why Mr. Sieverding got that position. In fact, on page 151, the question was posed to him, what qualifications did Joe Sieverding possess that made him the more qualified person for the acting central region delivery management practice director position in April or May 2004? Answer, Mr. Sieverding was immediately available and wouldn't require any type of transition from an activity he was currently engaged with. He had experience with a very large project in the strategic accounts, and myself and other people were involved in the decision were comfortable with him filling that role as an acting practice director. There's no evidence that that was a false answer, Your Honor. That's what the plaintiff has to show. Those were legitimate reasons in a situation where Mr. Gamzo was leaving on short notice, could have been back in a short period of time. They knew he was available. This isn't a decision where they thought about Ms. Fisher and said, oh, yeah, she's more qualified, but we're going to take Mr. Sieverney because he's a guy. There's no evidence of that at all.
How about Ms. Cain pointed out that there are very few women in this company, especially senior positions, and that the women complained about this and that there was no follow-up?
Well, the evidence was that there was follow-up. First of all, it's true there aren't many women at this company and there aren't many women in this industry, and that may be a bad thing, but that's a fact. The women did complain about this, and that summer they had sort of a retreat. And there ended up being a women's group that was put together within the organization. And frankly, since this litigation, the company continues to respond to those issues. But the decision makers at issue on these, I don't want to say small, minor matters involving Ms. Fisher, had no idea about these complaints to the top level people. They had no idea that Ms. Fisher was involved in those. So yes, there are some issues with the company about, are there women in management? There aren't, Your Honor. But it doesn't mean Ms. Fisher was.
Why do you say that top management didn't know about these problems?
No, top management did. Top management did. Mr. Slattery sort of handled the Chicago strategic account regions. This phone call with the women was with the head of HR, was with the CEO of the company, and it's a Seattle-based company, and the phone call was all with a bunch of folks in Seattle. And as you can probably imagine, the people in Seattle, although they put together this program in the summer, didn't announce to all the people out in the field that they had this call with 10 women complaining. And I'm not demeaning that situation, but the fact is it didn't sort of get into the people who were making the specific decisions about Ms. Fisher.
And the Gentlemen's Club? What was that?
Well, Your Honor, for Black Barber, it's a strip bar is what it is. Yeah. And it had happened years before. And
don't just give us the address.
Um, There had been a complaint that men had gone to a strip club, and the response, and this all predates, I think this is back in 02, the response was, hey, they've been working hard, let them do what they're going to do. There wasn't any adverse action. You know, boys will be boys, and I'm not condoning it, but it had nothing to do with Ms. Fisher. She complained about that or raised it to somebody. That was years before these other issues. As far as the constructive discharge claim, Your Honor, yes, she was discharged, or she quit. I mean, she just quit. She had been looking for a job, apparently, according to her testimony, since January. She took a job that was higher paying. At the time she quit, she had taken this new position in the central region, working with Don Evans. They had structured a government position for her, which she requested, according to the email. She wanted to get back into the government area. And the notion that they were like trying to force her out is completely inaccurate, and it doesn't even come anywhere near the standard that no reasonable person could have been forced to sort of go through that kind of a thing. So as far as the retaliation, the constructive discharge, there's no knowledge. Judge Hibbler also relied and said that they weren't adverse actions. That was sort of an extra reason. He didn't apply the Burlington standard, but I don't think that that's relevant because he also found that the person making the decision wasn't aware of the protected activity and also found that the reason for those adverse actions was not pretextual. There was valid business reasons for monitoring her expenses, given that nobody knew where she was and she wasn't communicating with people, and that also that her performance, they had identified her performance issues, that they were going to identify her as does not meet expectations. In June 28th, she didn't file her charge until July 21st, and they didn't receive the charge until August 1st or 2nd. It's a little bit unclear, but all of that occurred before the time that they were aware that she filed the charge. So,
but by that time, of course, they were aware that of her dissatisfaction because there had been this telephone call.
But the people that made the decision to look at her expenses and to give her a negative review, they weren't aware of that. There's no evidence whatsoever that they were aware of the phone call. She had done that. But the people, for retaliation, you have to know of the protected activity. So the company knew about it, but Mick Slattery didn't, and there was no evidence that he did. And the fact that other people in the organization knew about it and didn't communicate it to her is sort of irrelevant.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Paul.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Ms. Kane, how much time does she have?
With regard to counsel's position of the reason that Mr. Silverdine received the practice director position in the central region was a result of it being a stopgap. Just a matter of week could be a matter of 2 weeks. Well, it's just clearly not the case. And the evidence in this case actually shows that without considering the plaintiff, who they knew was looking to be promoted, was holding the position, sharing the position with Mr. Silverdine, he was slid into the position in the central region, and within months, October to be precise, he's got the position. It was never posted. And most importantly, Mr. Evans specifically testified that the reason that he got the position is because I appointed Mr. Silverdine.
Ms. Kane, during that shared period when
yes.
you both had it,
yes.
Is it true that Mendel received complaints from the employees regarding Fisher's leadership style?
Well, I mean, that's refuted by her performance appraisals, mm-hmm. Your Honor, which has also been encompassed in our statement of facts. And it appears, which is really unusual, especially because what we're talking about is managing the Federal Home Loan Bank. And the Federal Home Loan Bank recommended the plaintiff, not Mr. Silverdine. Nonetheless, Mr. Silverdine, who has these gigantic losses of $600,000.
Well, that loss issue, is that something that he lost it, or has he reduced it from a figure? I guess Mr. Boggs suggests that maybe he cut the losses on it. I mean, there's no question it was a rebate to the bank. But Mr. Boggs suggests that loss might have been greater if Mr. Silverdine hadn't been the manager. Do you contest that?
Yes, very much so.
No, I'm not contesting the amount of the loss, but his position is
I understand.
That you can't necessarily say because it's a loss that the management style was bad. It might have been a greater loss, Mr. Boggs suggests, if Mr. Silverdine hadn't been taken over a losing proposition. I mean, that's what he says.
I understand, Judge, but the fact of the matter is that the evidence that came out in the summary judgment, particularly in our statement of facts, specifically Mr. Silverdean didn't file the guidelines. And the reason for the loss is because of handshake deals rather than confirming things in writing. So I don't know how he's saving the money when there were guidelines he failed to follow, which ultimately resulted in this loss, of which there's also the corroborative testimony of Lisa Blessington, who was requested to do the audit of Mr. Silverdean's work.
Did his exceptional performance review of 03 precede that period?
Actually, it was subsequent to it, because in 2003 is when the incidences occur. He received the rating subsequent to those losses being aware of it.
So you see that as some sort of pretext by the company to give him that kind of rating after that performance?
Judge, respectfully so. I see a lot that tends to make one believe that there's so much evidence here that suggests that there's pretext. I mean, it's just one thing after the other. I mean, the case, while it really isn't that complex, it really isn't. The fact of the matter is these women could not forge ahead, and they tried, and they were doing their jobs, and they got recommendations. And nonetheless, positions weren't posted for them to be aware of it. That's actually the reason that is used by the defense specifically in this case is, oh, I wasn't aware that Barb Fisher was even interested. Well, how could she even know? You didn't post the position. There's no way for her to know it's even available, for her to even express her interest in this position. So, I mean, it's really one thing after the other. But with regard to the constructive discharge points that counsel made, I mean, as this court enunciated in Hunt versus the City of Markham, a person who is repeatedly told he's not wanted, has no future, and can't count on ever getting another raise would not be acting unreasonably if he decided that to remain with his employer would necessarily be inconsistent with even a minimal sense of self-respect and therefore intolerable. I mean, truthfully, when counsel is representing to you that there's no way that Slattery was aware of, you know, the complaints made by the plaintiffs, There's an email from Tracy Spielman on August 8th indicating we need to be careful of retaliation. And that went directly to Slattery before he issued the performance appraisal to Ms. Fisher, which was needs improvement. They were all aware. And quite frankly, I think it's very reasonable to assume that a trier of fact could decide that Ms. Fisher was discriminated and retaliated against. And I respectfully request that you reverse the district court's opinion.
And thank you, Ms. Kane.
Thank you so much.